Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. This is Dr. Brenda Moreau, and I appreciate you returning to learn more about how to intervene in support of your patient's development when you hear a positive projection. In episode number 5, I demonstrated how to determine if what you heard was a positive projection, and in this episode, I'm going to explore ways to intervene. Quick review on projections. They often signal something that the person is not aware of and likely needs to be developed in them. On the Connection Therapy Podcast, there is a series of episodes on projections, and the very first episode, number 1, is an introduction to projections, if you'd like to learn more. On this podcast, we provide episodes intended for a wide variety of audiences. The one you are listening to now is intended to support mental health therapists in considering ways to intervene in support of their adult patients' development when they hear a positive projection stated. I also hope it will be an engaging exploration for anyone interested in this topic, and I'm glad you are here. A positive projection in which someone is attributing a positive quality to someone else can symbolize an aspiration on the part of the speaker. So as therapists, we want to help our patients become aware of their unconscious motivations to determine if they want to take action by developing a skill or changing some of their behaviors in the service of that aspiration. Sometimes things are just compliments, and it is hard to distinguish a positive projection at first. In episode number 5, I discussed how I go about determining if what an adult patient said was a positive projection. I demonstrated how I use narration, where I primarily repeat what I heard in a supportive way to encourage the patient's further elaboration of the statement they made. I assess for the emotional quality of that statement and retrace any facts related to it while I am listening. In that example, I demonstrated how an imaginary patient's statement was a positive projection. She made a statement that was unexpected, and it displayed a latent quality of longing. She, in this case, is a fictional patient, and it is a fictional dialogue in which I demonstrated how to do this in episode 5. Yep. It took a full episode to discuss all the things to consider just to get to the point where you determine how you now may want to intervene, which is what I will share in this episode. But let's acknowledge, it is hard to wait this long to discuss an intervention, right? As mental health therapists, we usually enter the field because we want to do something. So now we are into a second episode about clinical work, and we have yet to do anything. But wait, we have done something. We have listened to her. And I think that is the point. The point is we need to learn what we need to do first before we just go start doing stuff. And that's why I spend a lot of time getting to the root of what was said before I start intervening. And I also refer out to theories and developmental models to know more about why I am intervening. Okay. Thank you for hanging in there this long. Let's see how we might start planning our interventions by learning about a developmental model that will help us decode some of her possible aspirations based on the needs at each human life stage. Especially when working with adults, I like Eric Erickson's 8-stage model for human development. I use the model to help me figure out if the projection is signaling something neither the patient nor I have considered up to this point. That is it signaling something in them that is developing now because they are maturing? I will illustrate how this works, but first let me introduce the theorist and the model briefly. Eric Erickson developed an 8-stage model for human development. He was originally a student of Sigmund and Anna Freud, although there was a falling out there, in part because his own theories started to diverge in new directions. In the book Freud and Beyond, A History of Modern Psychoanalytic Thought by Mitchell and Black, they discuss Erickson's view of the development of the ego as a continual process of tension between the drives, those innate qualities of our physical being and our socialization into the world and culture of which we are a part. The roots of this are in psychoanalytic structure. And if it has been a while since you heard those terms, let's remember the id, ego, and superego. Id being the innate instincts within us driven by our physical needs and urges, superego being ideals for behavior in a civilized world, however that is understood in our culture, and the ego in the middle trying to navigate these two poles to develop us as a unique human. For those steeped in psychoanalytic thought, that was way too quick of a summary that left out a lot. And for those skeptical of psychoanalytic theories, it is likewise too simple of a way to describe human development. So let me explain why I find it helpful as a clinician. First, there is no perfect model. As humans, we do tend to move in similar patterns across our life stages, of course, with unique expressions of it for each person. So in session, I'm trying to balance something I may not have considered for this patient while staying with her and what she said and what is unique to her. Erickson's model for me is a more straightforward model than some of the others for me to remember and use while I'm in session. Second, even if you don't agree with all of the psychoanalytic theories, and that's a healthy speculation, I find it helpful to carry a healthy skepticism of all assertions, so you're in good company here. But there is something to the fact that we have motivations that we are not yet aware of, and they often come up at the most inconvenient times in our lives. It can be so helpful to validate this experience for the person by normalizing it for them. So I like this model because it is an empathetic stance toward these dilemmas. And Erickson went further than the original discussion of id, ego, and superego. He included environmental stressors and personal history as part of the forces the individual has to navigate to arrive at the next level of development. The model is structured on how one resolves the conflicts the instinctual drives present while moderating the environmental and cultural stressors presented during each phase of development. So the idea is that we don't achieve a certain skill as humans and then never face that conflict again. Oh, wouldn't that be so nice? Instead, we consistently navigate these dilemmas throughout the lifespan. But what tends to happen is we do progress in our capability to meet each challenge. As I mentioned, there are 8 stages in the model. The first 5 are for child development, so I will address them in a later episode. The last 3 stages of the model are specific to adults, and they are stage 6, approximately from ages 20 to 44 years, and the conflict is between intimacy and isolation. Stage 7, between 45 and 64 years, the conflict is generativity and stagnation. Stage 8, 65 and older, the conflict is ego integrity versus despair. The model changed slightly over the years, and so you may see different age ranges and things listed for each stage, but that is another reason why this model is helpful to me. It has flexibility. Let's consider each of the adult stages briefly to give you an overview. For stage 6, age 20 to 44 years, the conflict is intimacy versus isolation. The model is framed as a challenge to resolve two forces. Is one going to move toward intimacy with others or toward isolation? By this time in one's development, humans typically have experienced the sheer infatuation common in the teenage years. And sadly, then, they have also experienced the profound disappointment of realizing the fantasy of another loving us completely in the ways we wish are not realistic. The teenage years in the previous stage included intense swings of emotion, and no matter what stage you're at now, we all remember that roller coaster. We can be fairly certain each human has experienced some intense swings of emotions in the previous years by the time they enter stage 6, because the body has gone through puberty and had to work out how to balance the hormones, as well as in the late teens, early 20s, rethreaded the area at the top of the head that bridges the brain lobes. It's called the corpus callosum, and the thing to take away here is that the physical body has just been through a lot of work. And this is in part why we can be certain an adult in stage 6 is just coming out of that. And so they realize the draining nature of these intense swings. So at this stage, there arises a corresponding move toward isolation to protect us from these intense swings. While we can't control all of the things about our physical body, we at this point have realized that relationships with others seem to be a complicating factor in these roller coaster swings. Yet the problem is, as humans, we tend to be social creatures by nature, and something in us drives us toward that companionship that often causes some of those exact problems. So in this stage, we are working out how to moderate that need with our corresponding reaction to it. Generally, a successful resolution of the conflict Erickson presents between intimacy and isolation is gaining the skills to balance our own needs with the needs of others. And so there is a lot of awareness building of other people at this stage. This is often a time when young adults cohabitate in either college dorms or big cities with small apartments. So we are forced quickly into the realization that not everyone does things like our family of origin does. And we have to navigate things such as, how are we going to keep a home that is clean enough for all to reside comfortably within it? We are learning to distinguish our unique needs from those of others and figuring out how to cooperate in order that we can have mutually satisfying relationships, kind of a balance of give and take. So a quick generalization of this stage is that a successful resolution of it, according to Erickson, is the learning of how to navigate and maintain balance between the drive toward intimacy and the corresponding reaction to isolation. For stage 7, age 45 to 64 years, the conflict is generativity versus stagnation. So here we are looking at the challenge of navigating between the two forces of generativity versus stagnation. By this time in human development, we see humans on the whole having had a decade or more in the workforce, possibly somewhere in the process of raising a family, and some considerations of community involvement, for example, helping out at their children's schools, spiritual pursuits, things like that. To me, models like this hold their value when you look around the culture and see examples of them. This is, of course, where the term midlife crisis would apply, and it is on the heels of the previous stage where we might have said someone was settling down. So why would a crisis present a few years later for some people? Erickson would say it is the dilemma between the need for generativity, that is, to produce something in the world that is unique to one's purpose, one's values, and the converse problem, which is the draw toward the monotonous. Life is difficult by this time. Many people have many, many obligations, and one way to get them efficiently completed is to develop a routine. Routines are great until they aren't. At this stage, we often find people wanting ways to balance the need for routine and completion of responsibilities while also feeling like one's efforts have a purpose, a meaning, and that they are not just running on that proverbial hamster wheel, if you will. While you may not ascribe to this theory, I will say it is uncanny how often it comes up. If not an overt statement about the wish to give back, you will hear people in this age range start to make statements about larger purposes than they may have previously been worried about. It can be framed as the effort to leave a legacy of some sort. People in this stage are often becoming acutely aware of what things will be like after they are gone. from their job, for example, or from being an active participant in their children's lives. And so they start to wonder what their efforts have yielded. And since they aren't done yet, so to speak, they usually start to consider all these roles to see if this is how they want things to be. Some find that it isn't. And this is where you see people consider ways to restart their involvement in community or try to ensure that the next generation has things better than they did, quote, quote. You also can see a regression to the previous stages. Maybe in the teenage years, some ideals were formed about how to have a perfect life. And then in the early adult years, there becomes a feeling that somehow if one is able to arrive at that right station in life, that is the perfect job, family, partner, then our dreams will come true. At this stage, there is the discomfort that begins to gnaw at them. It is normal to consider if one had just made different choices that they might be happier now. A feeling that somehow it is one's station in life, that is the job, partner, family that were selected, that might be the thing that's yielding the discomfort, begins to kind of wear on them. And they start to wonder, if they had just made different decisions, maybe they would be happier now. While that may be true, this is where the model for me really comes alive. Because someone can be representing that their concerns are with their boss at work or their partner at home, and they may be. But as a therapist, if you can key into the possibility that they need to develop the generativity side of this dilemma and help them find ways to feel creative and be productive rather than ask for those needs to be solved by the other people in their lives, you will be able to help your patients significantly. Please note, when I use the word productive here, I'm not intending in the common sense of accomplishing a list of tasks. In fact, that's the last thing we want to ask people in this stage to look at. They already feel like they are doing everything they can do and more and still aren't happy. So we are not going to encourage more task lists. Going back to Erickson's actual term, generativity, it is the sense of whatever those special creative moments are for the person, taking them from their dreams and producing them in the actual world. That to me is what Erickson means by generativity. You are generating your own unique special blend of creativity in the world that only you can do, and there is something profoundly satisfying about that. For stage 8, 65 and older, the conflict is ego integrity versus despair. For stage 8, we are looking at integrating our life experiences. Some things have hopefully gone well so that we can have an appreciation of them. And inevitably, some things have not gone well. That is normal for a human life. One thing that fascinates me about this stage of human life is how vastly different each person is. It is the time in our lives where we are least likely to be like our same age peers. To better explain, let me go back and let's imagine in the early years, like infancy, we track fairly certain to our same age peers. For example, when we start to roll over, walk, and talk as young children, those activities are on average within a few months for nearly all children. And that is in part because there are biological imperatives that bring on those skills at certain times. Many of the skills come online when our younger siblings would need more attention from caregivers. So we must start to do things independently for the best chances of success for each child. Even if we don't have younger siblings, our human biology seems to track with certain timelines for certain skills. But at this later stage of life, stage 8, the abilities and capacities are not at all on similar timelines any longer. The factors of one's life, someone's experience of what they have done for work, where they have lived, traveled, how they spent their free time, the qualities and experiences in their relationships, and their physical health, all these things combined to make drastically different outcomes for people. So you can meet a 65-year-old who is planning to go climb Mount Kilimanjaro right after they retire, and then you can meet another 65-year-old later the same week who needs to start downsizing their home in preparation for assisted living. For some people, neither of those activities may sound like something they want to be doing, and that is the point of this stage. Ego integrity, as Erickson suggested, is figuring out all the things that make up the needs of the unique person and integrating those experiences that have occurred into a patchwork quilt, so to speak, and then seeing what remains to be sewn into the fabric, if you will. The despair side of this conflict at stage 8 is to get stuck in the sheer pain that comes with things not going as well as one may have hoped. It is very normal and appropriate to have sadness across the lifespan. Let me say that again. It is very normal and appropriate to have sadness across the lifespan. It is just part of being human that we all have had sad, bad, good, sometimes okay, sometimes interesting, all the types of experiences. And it is common to experience despair, very common actually, and happens multiple times in the lifespan. The idea of ego integrity is to integrate all the experiences and keep going, keep keeping ourselves open to new experiences. What is not so intuitive at first glance is that if we can mourn the losses of whatever is causing us despair, the loss of a spouse, the onset of a disease that prevents our later stage of life looking like we had planned, the state of the world for the younger generations and realizing our personal effect on it is diminishing, whatever those things that cause us despair, we will be better able to move forward if we can grieve these losses. It sounds strange, but it works. So what does it even mean to have ego integrity or to integrate an experience? I keep saying that, but what do I mean? In this, I include a concept from D.W. Winnicott, whom I introduced in episode number 3. Winnicott suggested a concept called the good enough mother. We can apply this to nearly everything and every person, but in his original supposition, he suggested that there is no such thing as a perfect mother, only one who is good enough to support a child into successful maturity. So as I say, this applies to all caregivers and beyond. For example, we don't need a perfect teacher, we just need to have one good enough to help us learn. And this is important for us as mental health therapists. We don't have to be a perfect therapist, only one that is good enough. To further his point, we have learned through attachment theory perspectives that he was correct. And in fact, a stronger attachment is made between children and parents and in all relationships if that relationship has experienced a break and then a successful repair. These relationships who have gone through a break and then been repaired tend to be stronger than if the relationship had always been perfect. And so in this way, I take Winnicott's idea and apply it to stage 8, in that we can hopefully arrive at a place where we have had a good enough life. I know it sounds anticlimactic, but it's actually a pretty great thing. So at this stage 8, the work is integrating the experiences into a whole, that is balancing out all the years, relationships, memories, and seeing them all to the point where one feels they have arrived at a moment of a good enough life. Then they can decide how they want to spend their time more consciously after a full picture has been more realized. Like, what more things do they want to add into this full picture of their good enough life? Okay, so now what? We've learned about the stages of development, and before that, we learned about how to identify the patient's projection. Okay, so, right, there are many options to intervene that would be therapeutic. But for purposes of our example, I'm going to explain how I do this in general overall, and then I'm going to give 3 distinct interventions for each of the 3 stages. So let's just review. First, the patient has identified a projection, which we explained in episode 1 can be a signal to where they need to develop. So we want to do the work we did in episode 5 to delineate the meaning of the projection. And this often leads to a good-bad discussion. Someone else has or does something that is good, and the person has or does something that is bad. With all projections, we are going to start by supporting the patient and balancing this out, so the merits of either circumstance can be recognized. On the positive projection, it usually signals some type of aspiration, so we want to balance the teeter-totter a bit, if you will, so that the aspiration is within reach for our patient. Then, since we are helping them place this aspiration into a potential need for development that life may be asking of them as they mature, We are going to consider the poles of each of the adult stages for the development that Erickson described. We want to do this to consider the aspiration as a signal toward some type of development asked by the stage they are currently navigating. Intimacy versus isolation for stage 6, generativity versus stagnation for stage 7, and ego integrity versus despair for stage 8. So let's return to our fictional patient to see some examples of how this could work. She's waited a long time for us to provide her some support. Let's see how we might be able to help. So back to our fictional patient. She is an adult, and at the moment, that is all we know about her, because we are going to consider her at 3 different ages in her adulthood and see how that guides the interventions we might consider. We learned in the previous episode she had an encounter with a friend from high school that is a really good artist, and now that friend illustrates for a major card company. The patient was likewise good at art, and their paths diverged upon going to college, where the friend's parents valued creativity and provided for her to obtain a degree in art. The patient's parents did not think art would lead to a stable career, so they sent her to school for economics. She now has a job she says she hates and explains she has no passion for it. So the positive projection that struck my ear was when she referred to her friend as a really good artist. As you will remember from the previous episode, number 5, the way the positive statement about the friend being a, quote, really good artist was off rhythm from the other updates, and the wistful, emotional quality with which she first stated it helped me to identify it as a positive projection. Differentiating it in this way helped realize through exploration that it was not just a compliment extended to her friend, but that the positive projection is signaling an area for development with the patient. Then we learn more about what the projection represents for her. The friend is described as a good, quote, quote, artist, so that tells me there is usually a flip side, a bad, quote, quote, side, or thing that happened. As I elaborated on in the earlier episode, it appears as though the difficult choice between valuing creativity and valuing stability is how she perceived what happened for her friend and for her when their paths went in different directions in college, her friend for an art degree and she for an economics degree. In this way, we consider that she might be feeling like the friend took the good path, and instead she took the bad path of going for a degree in economics. As we just discussed, all of Erickson's stages have a conflict associated with them. And what I do is I then start to see if she might be working on resolving one of those conflicts. Because also in the previous episode, we discussed that at this point in the fictional treatment with this fictional patient, she has not brought up an interest in art or creativity before. So tying this all in now as to how it works to apply a positive projection in reference to Erickson's developmental stages. Well, the patient has brought up a time in her own life where she is indicating her frustration with a significant life choice having been made for her by her parents. Where we can support her is to consider how she may have freedom to make a different choice at this point in her life. And since she is explaining it as a significant one that was made, we can guess that our best way to help her is illuminate some upcoming big choices in her life at this moment. And Erickson's model helps us frame where those might be, based on where she fits chronologically within the stages of development. Let's imagine this fictional patient at 3 different ages, one in each of the Erickson adult life stages. Okay, for stage 6, the range is from 20 to 44 years. Let's imagine she is 29 years old. She graduated with her degree in economics and has been working in the field for about 7 years. So let's consider what happens in general for people who are 29 years old. While they have been an adult legally for about a decade, it is still a time when there is considerable freedom. But around 29 years old, most people tend to gain awareness of how the steps made up to this point in their life have placed them in a certain spot. It is common for there to be a reckoning of sorts, where people consider how they want to plan their next steps by realizing the implications of big decisions and reflecting on ones made in the past. And this is where we find our patient. She has been in her job long enough to realize how she feels about it, and the encounter with her friend appears to have triggered the memory that she could have gone a different route, that is, to become a professional artist. The other thing that tends to occur at around 29 years old is the recognition that as adults, we need to begin parenting ourselves, so to speak. The patient's parents made decisions for her that are being brought up in therapy today, and this could mean she is in front of a big decision and wondering which way she will go with it. Like, will she value creativity now, or will she follow the lead of her parents and value stability? If we take the statement at face value, we might find ourselves suggesting she find an art class to fulfill her passions. This is the most obvious place to start, but that doesn't mean it is the right one. A lot of times, art and creative instincts represent a need for freedom or for one to develop their own unique path. So, how can I help her? She may actually be bringing this up today because she is considering something substantial in her own life, and she needs the ability to have confidence in her decisions about it. And she may actually need to work out how to do that in therapy. The problem with this conflict that is between creativity and stability is that we need both. As humans, we need both the ability to be creative and the feeling of stability. And many people start to become aware at this stage that all the people in their world up to this point who put limits on them, for example, parents, teachers, principals, they are all now clearing the way, and our patient here, as a young adult, has more freedom than she ever has. In this fictional example, she's been in an economics job for about 7 years, so she's probably got some money and some means along with that freedom. At first, this is great! Yahoo! And then some sobering realities start to creep in that with freedom comes responsibility, and this includes the need for some stability. One of the most difficult things about becoming an adult is the fact that we now have to decide for ourselves how we will spend our time and our resources. And as her therapist, we need to support her in exploring if this positive projection about her friend, who is a really good artist, is something she really wants to take hold of. As in, was it a passing thought about a friend she has not seen in a while, or is it really something that is going to be on her mind until she resolves it for herself? Most of us have an internal voice that we can still repeat of different things our elders have told us to do or not to do. This replays often for many major decisions in life, and at some point this voice starts to sound like our own, or at least it enters the discussion as we mull things over in our minds. So within the frame of stage 6, intimacy versus isolation, it may be that she is considering a different career, but that she herself is now thwarting the opportunity because she has grown enough to realize that the insight from her parents into the economics of adulthood has some legitimacy. Usually career choices at this point are tied in somehow to the dilemma between intimacy and isolation because one is aware that their choice of vocation will impact the other people, partners, children, that may become part of their life in the future. Or maybe a romantic interest is the concern that she actually is thinking about today, and the dilemma is between a creative partner and a stable partner. Maybe she's considering going back to school for the art degree after all to reconnect with a community of artists because the economics job is so isolating. Or maybe she's even considering something like buying her first home and whether or not to buy a small condo in the heart of the city, where there is intimacy whether we want it or not because the walls are never thick enough, or she might buy something more practical in a suburb with a good commute to her job. Since she is a fictional patient that I'm bringing up with the hopes of exploration from a general view, it probably makes sense to stop fictionalizing the histories. The point is that you want to consider what she has brought into session from two angles. The first is the conflict between valuing creativity and valuing stability that the elaboration on the positive projection revealed. And now we want to apply the lens of the 6th developmental stage to consider specific things that she may be facing in the conflict between intimacy and isolation. stage 7, age 45 to 64 years. Let's imagine our fictional patient is in her late 40s, early 50s. She's been working in the field of economics for about 25 years. She is a mother of 4 children and has been married to her partner for 20 years. Now we are considering that same idea of valuing creativity versus valuing stability, but in the context of stage 7, where life is going to start asking her to work on the struggle between generativity versus stagnation. We can imagine her being in a difficult spot because with 4 children, she does not have much choice but to value the economic stability she has from the career she has held all these years. Yet, life seems to know that she once had a strong creativity streak, so this encounter with her friend has triggered that memory. And now that she has entered into stage 7, something strange has started happening, and that is, despite all of her responsibilities that she has lined up in a pretty solid routine, she recently has started experiencing this gnawing sensation that she needs to be more generative and somehow add more things to her already overflowing plate. It can be really alarming for people at this stage to come to the point and not understand why they are not happy, not fully satisfied, because they have, quote, done all the things that were supposed to lead to a happy life, and yet there is this weird gnawing at them to do more. Some potential scenarios for her we can imagine are that she might be considering a second career, but more likely she is also realizing, if her children are thinking about college, that she now will be in a position to thwart their possible career choices, much in the same way her parents did for her. One thing to note about how to intervene is to remember there are all kinds of ways that an unconscious motivation revealed by a positive projection wants to return to being unknown. These motivations are difficult to bring to awareness because they force some type of reckoning with ourselves. So this process can take weeks or months or even years, depending on how strong the motivation becomes and how resistant we are to finding a way to have it be expressed. In these first discussions after it comes up, I like to find a place where it can live, so to speak, for a while, without having to be resolved immediately in the first session it is discussed. You may remember from episode 5, the ways the fictional patient's emotional tone changed when she started talking about the job she hates. And as I mentioned, it is common that there's some negative tone coming back once the positive projection is in the room and the person realizes that we're going to attend to it. Their defenses come up. And as I mentioned in that episode, all the defenses about the fears and concerns of what this aspirational quality might mean for them, or how their life may change or not change again if they were to look in that direction, and if they would be able to go for it or not, and maybe further disappointed, all those things come rushing forward to prevent potential pain. If you can remain as neutral as possible using that narration technique, you will see your patient take both sides of the polarization. In fact, that's the intervention at this point, is to make space for her to start working this out for herself. She may endorse this unexplained urge to be more creative lately, something like, yeah, right before I saw my friend, I was actually thinking about picking up a paintbrush. And then she quickly squelched it down. But who has time for that? I gotta put food on the table. Carol Gilligan called these contrapuntal voices, where in the same sentence, someone is both for and against whatever it is. And that is okay. The way I work is that I don't need to take a side on either one of those, especially when I witness them being on either side of a developmental life stage like this, the generativity versus stagnation. I just need to witness the person themselves working it out, because a lot of what it has to do with is her own realization that she is about to come face to face with a quality or a wish, and she is going to have to decide whether or not she is going to pursue it this time in her adulthood. Given her responsibilities, she may not have the ability to go for that career in art. But for Erickson, finding ways to help her encourage her own generativity, that special blend of uniqueness that is hers to contribute, will help her navigate this stage. Stage 8, 65 years and older. Ego integrity versus despair. Let's assume she is 65 years old at the beginning of this stage. In the United States, she will shortly reach the retirement eligibility age, and it is not too much of a reach to guess that one reason the encounter with her friend has caught her attention is that she is coming to the end of the road she took when she last saw her friend. That is, their paths diverged in college, which was the step that launched their different careers. Now our imaginary patient is nearing the end of her career, and she has a decision to make. This time, as the adult, she must decide if and when she will stop working in this career. At this point in her life, she is about 40 years past the decision her parents made that influenced her economics degree. And that likely means that she internalized their thinking that stability was to be valued. So if she is still ascribing her circumstances from that time to her staying in the field of economics all these years, for example, in the vignette, we have her explaining that she is in a job she hates and wishes every week for Friday to arrive, that is likely the place to start intervening. This stage is about ego integrity. And among many things, it is the idea that we begin to make sense of our lives, that we sum things up in a way. It is a time of integrating the ups and downs, sweet and bitter moments in the thread of our life. And it is also a time of taking responsibility for the decisions we made. While her parents may have influenced her economics degree, she has had opportunities to change that trajectory. And by implication, she has agreed with them that valuing stability over creativity was important. If she has stayed in the field of economics all this time, we can surmise that she has the means to retire. In fact, our imaginary patient may have been able to retire much earlier, and for some reason she is just now bringing this up in the therapy session. This is likely because after all this time, she has internalized the idea that stability was paramount. By internalized, I mean she has taken her parents' guidance and lived by it all this time, meaning she has either consciously or unconsciously agreed with this viewpoint and lived her life accordingly. And likely this is coming up now because she is aware she will eventually need to decide what is next. She can keep working to be sure, but this developmental stage is signaling a change is coming for her. The U.S. retirement age is nearing, but will she take retirement or will she keep working? Someone who has valued stability for so many years is at least in some way going to face the unstructured nature of retirement with some underlying dread. Ego integrity versus despair. From a psychoanalytic point of view, we can imagine her integrating different parts of herself. She definitely has integrated the stability side of the values. And now at this stage, she may have the aspiration to remember what it was like to be a good artist. And so the task would be to find a way to integrate the parts of herself that at this point have not been realized in her life, and to find a way to do it within the constraints of her current life circumstances. Thank you so much for joining me in this exploration of different ways to support this fictional patient. Hopefully by now, you realize she is fictional because she is symbolic for things most patients experience at some point in our work with them. In fact, as you can see, most humans experience these things. Working with projections helps me to support people in being more aware of and feeling more like they can make the choices they want for their lives. And choice tends to be a big factor in improving mental health. You may be wondering at this point, what happens to projections if they are not addressed? Well, in my experience, they will keep coming up if they are developmentally pertinent to this chronological stage. So if you miss one or two, you'll have the opportunity to address them at some point. And what if the patient does not want to realize them? Well, she has the ability to not address the aspiration for development. And in my observation, what helps her the most is gaining awareness of her choices, as opposed to when it was less in her awareness and felt like something forced upon her. That is one reason why I am keen to not influence my own agenda onto the treatment, even if I think I may know what is best for her. Because then I become just like her parents in this example, where my own values may influence her decisions. I was taught once by an excellent supervisor that people really don't come to therapy because they want us to do things. They come to therapy because they want us to be with them as they go through difficulties. It is among the wisest pieces of advice I have heard, because when we are in session with someone who is really desperate for answers, it is hard not to start racking our own brains for possible solutions. But what has worked best for me is to take the advice from my previous supervisor and develop my own skill to tolerate distress. Of course, this assumes we are not in an active crisis situation. That's different. But assuming everyone is safe enough, I try to develop my capacity to hold the tension the patient brings in so that together we can create a space where they can start to find room to breathe while they figure out this very difficult thing in their life. This is especially relevant when working with patients and their projections. By definition, these things have been unconscious, and in this episode, we are considering them as part of life's developmental stages. We are not going to solve all of this for our patient in the span of 1 hour. So, we are going to hold these aspirations and challenges with them while honoring that they will make decisions when the time is right for them. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. If you would like to learn more about the authors and the studies listed in this episode, you'll find more information about them on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. And if you'd like to take a step further, we offer additional ways you can collaborate with us. Maybe you would like to confidentially discuss a case or do some additional consulting. We'd be happy to speak with you. We also have study groups where you have the opportunity to join and gain more knowledge in a supportive environment. These are small groups where we share and explore the podcast topics and more in detail. And in some states, your time spent in the group may be able to qualify toward your continuing education requirements for many licensure types. You will find more information on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. Thanks. Until next time.